Lee, John Wallach, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krogh-Meadows. I want to say tomorrow on Thanksgiving, our Thanksgiving special will be Who Put the Rainbow in the Wizard of Oz? A look at the life of blacklisted lyricist Yip Harburg. And then on Friday, we look at the basis of many elite universities, their connection to slavery. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with host Lisa Loving. Today's guest is local journalist, filmmaker, and comic book writer David Walker, who has just written a book on the importance of independent media.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
Tune in Wednesday at 9 a.m. for a special political perspectives show. Teresa Mitchell will interview Michael Kimmel, author of Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. Hear about Michael Kimmel's research interviewing a variety of angry white men, from white supremacists to men's rights activists to schoolboys, to try to figure out what makes them so furious. That's Wednesday at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle accepts like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, and accessories for consignment or store credit. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and on the web at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com or FullCircleResalePortland.com.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
It is 8:03, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today, David Walker. What a gift. His newest book, Becoming Black, but also he's got the young adult novel, Super Justice Force. David, thank you so much for coming here.
Thanks for having me on this wonderful sort of, it's kind of foggy out this morning, isn't it?
It's cold without being an ice storm.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's good. It's good to be out in you know, to, I'm usually up this early. I'm up early every morning. I just usually don't face the day this early.
David Walker, you remember, David Walker had spent, I want to say, 7 years as the film editor at the Willamette Week. He was the founder of the Longbaugh Film Festival there, an independent film festival. We're talking to a man who is dedicated to independent media. I'm putting that out. David, I want to freak you out, though.
Okay.
Can I freak you out?
Sure.
I want to say, David Walker's appeal to the colored citizens of the world, right? do you ever read that, David Walker's appeal?
Oh, yes. I have a copy of it sitting on my bookshelf at home. It's actually one of my dream projects, is to make a movie about my namesake. I was not named after him per se. It just, you know, both David and Walker are fairly common names. But he was an amazing revolutionary abolitionist and a human rights activist. And his story has still not been fully and adequately written about.
1830 is when that book was first published. Yes. I just want to put that out. Are we resolving the issues?
No, not at all. I actually think you can get a copy of David Walker's appeal. Yeah. I think it's free online. I think like Guggenheim Press or Google Docs or something has it free. But I refer to it quite often when I'm feeling down and out, and then I want to remind myself that, oh, things have not been hunky-dory for a long time. So
more than 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
David Walker's appeal is so interesting, and there is more about that. There's an interesting project called DavidWalkerMemorial.org. It's out of Boston. But David, more about you.
Okay.
So David Walker, I feel as though maybe you're a graduate student. You went back to school. You've been working on books. You've done so much. And of course, your website, Badass Mofo. Talk about these two books. Let's start out talking about Super Justice Force. That's close to your heart. That project has been for a while.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Super Justice Force is my young adult novel. It's the first in a series of three books. Maybe about halfway through the second book right now. The series is called The Adventures of Darius Logan. And it started really simply. I was looking for a book for my godson to buy him for Christmas or his birthday or whatever. And I had just a really short list of criteria, and I could not meet that list. And really what I wanted was, I just wanted a really good book that, you know, was sort of in the Harry Potter vein or the Percy Jackson vein, but I wanted a book with a hero of color. It was very important to me, because when I was a kid, that's what I wanted, and I could not find it. I didn't want to buy A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich. You know, that was the book everybody read when I was a kid, Alice B. Childress. I did not want a book set in, you know, whether it was an urban dysfunction, civil rights movement, sports. I want a book set in the world of fantastic. That's what I wanted when I was a kid. And then 30 something years later, I sort of opened my eyes and realized, oh, that book still doesn't exist. And Toni Morrison famously said, I'm going to mangle this quote, but if there's a book that you want to read and it's not out there, you have to write it yourself. Mm-hmm. That's not, again, I kind of mangled the quote, but so that's what set me off. And then as I was writing the book, I started learning more about literacy amongst teenagers. And then when the book was done and I was looking for a publisher, I kept hearing the same things over and over again, which was teen boys don't read.
Yeah, we hear that.
And then I was hearing things like, oh, well, your character is very hard to relate to, which is code.
Yeah, it means that.
And yep. and so I took all of those messages and got really depressed, and then got really angry, or maybe got angry and then depressed. I can't quite remember the order. And I just decided, well, I'm going to put the book out myself. Because it was literally rejected by every major publisher in North America. And those publishers that rejected it, it wasn't like a short little rejection. It was these long explanations as to why they were turning the book down. That it was one or two, you know, it was just like one or two sentences away from saying, but we could actually do something with this book. And I was explaining.
Hold on a second. Yeah. So I know a little bit about book publishing. I am personally a failed book author. And if you have these people writing letters to you, they get like a bazillion things. They get a bazillion submissions. So if they're actually writing something, that's very rare. So if they're writing a long letter of guilt, that's a remarkable thing. That's almost worthy of its own book.
I was talking to someone the other day going over this story, and I was telling them that, and I won't name the publisher, but it was the top publisher on my list. I got three rejections from them. Three
Not
rejections.
Just no, but no, no, no.
Well, three rejections that amounted to three letters from three editors.
Right.
And each rejection was like, I'm sorry, I can't do anything with this book, but I'm going to give it to another editor who might be able to do something with it. And so what it kept saying was, we don't want to try. And it would be one thing if it was, it's not my book that's the problem. The problem is when you tell me teen boys don't read, then that says to me that we have given up on an entire segment of the population. And you know, we could get into the discussion of how video games are marketed towards teen boys, or how
movies,
yeah, movies, all these other things. That doesn't make it any, you know, more right or wrong. It just means that we have a problem with balance in this country when it comes to everything, whether it's gender, whether it's race, whether it's, you know, anything. And to me, I would much rather teen boys read than play video games. You know?
What are teen boys supposed to read if there's nothing that's pitched to them that's made of interest to them? So it's like, what, you know, what came first, the chicken or the lame publishing company?
Exactly. And so, you know, and I feel like, you know, and I've had this argument all the time where people are like, well, there's a lot of great books out there. And I'm like, yeah, there are great books. But if you put yourself into the shoes of a 13, 14, 15 year old boy, young man, and you look at some of these books, and it's like, when I was that age, I wouldn't be caught dead holding some of these books. Because when you're a young man, when you're a teenager, there's, you know, I don't want one of these, I call them the angel porn books. And they're like, you know, like all of James Patterson's books, where it's got, you know, a man with no shirt on and angel wings. And it's like, you know, I was too hung up on too many identity issues at that age to really feel comfortable being seen reading a book like that. And there's no way I could have read a book like Twilight when I was a kid, because I couldn't read the Twilight books as an adult.
Okay, you know? I have to jump in here now. Okay. So my daughter, I love my daughter. She's coming home today for the holiday. She loved The Hunger Games, right?
Yeah.
Which is a series.
Yep.
Now, can you talk about the racial politics of what happened between the book and the movie theater? Because she was freaked out when she saw how basically a whole bunch of the characters of color were erased in the film, including the star?
Yeah, the main character? That bothered me. That bothered me, but not nearly as much as, yeah, for people that don't know, The Hunger Games is a book by Suzanne Collins. The new movie is out. The first movie came out, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago. When the first movie came out, there were two characters in the book that were clearly described as people of color. That was Rue, and I can't remember the other character's name, Thresh or something like that. And in the movie, they cast actors of color in that part, and people went absolutely berserk, because clearly people don't know how to read. They don't understand what certain adjectives
mean. There was
mean.
a huge backlash because people, yeah, it was fascinating.
They were like, well, Rue was supposed to be white, and spoiler alert, when the character of Rue gets killed, when you're reading the book, you're sobbing because it's a horrible, gut-wrenching scene. And it was a horrible, gut-wrenching scene in the film, but part of the backlash was people saying, I just didn't care. You know, it wasn't like I remember reading someone's Facebook comment about how, well, it wasn't like a human being got killed.
Are you kidding me?
I'm totally serious. And so I got in trouble because I said, well, you know, Suzanne Collins needs to address this. Suzanne Collins is the writer. And she didn't say, as far as I can know, she did not say a word. And I got into a lot of arguments with people because people were saying, well, it's not her responsibility. And I was like,
it's her art.
It might not be her responsibility, but what she needs to let these fans know, these fans who are racist, that they're being racist. She made the decision to make these characters look this way for whatever reason. Maybe it was just the flip of a coin. You know, she was like, heads, the character will be Asian, tails, the character will be black, whatever. But she made the character this way. And then for people to come out and say these things, especially, we're in the, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, it's the 21st century, you know? I mean, the fact that we have to say these things, and then people go, well, are we ready to have this dialogue now? Are we ready to talk about race?
Apparently some are not.
And you know, and the answer to that question is no. We've never been ready. We never will be ready.
Right. Define ready.
Yeah. It's like, am I ready to pay my taxes, you know, in January? No. Am I ready to pay my rent next month? No. Am I ready to, you know, go to the doctor and find out that I've got pneumonia and I need to be on antibiotics? No. We're never ready for just about anything. But that doesn't mean... It excuses us
right.
from not doing it, you know? I mean, if and that's the thing that just drives me bonkers, because I'm not ready for a lot of things, you know? I wasn't ready to come here this morning, but I put on a pair of pants, I got in the car, I came over.
You know, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live in Studio 2 with David Walker. We're talking about his newest books, Darius Logan, Super Justice Force. It is a young adult novel. Yes. And his book of essays, Becoming Black, Personal Ramblings on Racial Identification, Racism, and Popular Culture. I really want to dive into the book of essays, but we still haven't heard enough about Super Justice Force. Who is Darius Logan? What's going on in that book? Who should be reading it?
Everybody should be reading that book, to be honest with you. I got a phone call from a woman who's does PR work, and we're talking about doing some publicity, and her daughter's reading the book, and her daughter's 7, and I was floored because up until this point, the youngest person who's read the book has been like 12. Mm-hmm. The oldest has been in their 60s, and I get far more emails from people than I have reviews that have been generated at this point. But it's I had one kid who was about 13 or 14 describe the book to me. They said, "Oh, it's like Harry Potter meets Spider-Man, only different and better." And so I figure that's what I tell people now all the time. It's like Harry Potter meets Spider-Man, only different and better. It is about a kid. He's 17 years old. He's an orphan. He gets in trouble with the law. He's African-American. His name's Darius Logan. He gets in trouble with the law, and he's about to be tried and convicted as an adult and go to prison for a crime that he did commit, but circumstances are very there's very specific circumstances around the crime he committed.
Is that set in the future? Is that contemporary now?
In the very near future. Okay. I mean, if someone put my feet to the fire, I would say it's set probably about 3 or 4 years from now, but in a very different world. And instead of going to prison, he is remanded to an experimental rehab program that is operated not for first-time offenders, but for people who are just getting out of prison. And it's a rehabilitation program that takes criminals and gives them jobs in the workforce. But the workforce happens to be working for a team of superheroes. So Super Justice Force is a major corporation. Imagine if Disney actually had real superheroes working for them. They make, Disney makes the Iron Man movie.
That's a really scary thought. Don't make me think that, because I don't see Disney as a force for good, right?
Well,
like Google.
Yes.
Don't be evil, but they are. I'm putting that out.
Yeah, no. So he goes to work for Super Justice Force as part of their operations crew. And the concept being that this team of superheroes, someone has to do the laundry and someone has to give the guided tours of the headquarters and
the Batcave.
Yeah, exactly. And that was sort of the idea. It was like, who makes, what are the forces behind superheroes? Who makes the day-to-day operations run? And so Darius goes to work for that particular branch of the corporation. And everybody he works with are ex-criminals. They're all rehabilitated criminals. And so part of what I'm doing...
That's totally fascinating.
...is, I'm playing with the notion of good and bad. And so, his mentors are these guys. There's Otto Recker, who was, this famous supervillain, and El Toro Loco, who was a famous supervillain. And now these are just regular family guys. And that's a huge part of what we're getting into, is the concept of who's a hero and who's a villain. And then in the later books, we're going to sort of get into the evils of a corporation and what happens when even a team of superheroes, when their bottom line is they got to make money.
This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live in Studio 2 with David Walker, and he is an author, a journalist, a reviewer. He does all kinds of stuff. We're talking about his newest books, Super Justice Force, Darius Logan, Super Justice Force, and he also has a book of essays, Becoming Black. I'm trying to remember the name of this novel that was about superheroes that I really loved, and it came out like 10 years ago, but it was about... the bad guy. It was a novel about the anti-hero.
Oh, Soon I Will Be Invincible. Is that the book you're
so,
talking about?
Yeah. Soon I Will Become. Yeah, yeah, I Soon love I that book. Some, and you start to realize what a stupid douche the good guys are, and that the whole thing is all totally relative. And of course, Batman movies give you that already. Playing around with good and evil. Now I want to be weird, a little bit weird, and say, when we're talking about books like this, about good versus evil, are you really looking at what we have inside us? I mean, on a deeper level, a real personal level for your readers, are you looking at the sort of moral relativism that we all live with every day?
Yes, I'm looking at that. And then I'm also looking at not just moral relativism, but situational morality. and looking at the fact that, you know, Darius is this kid who is about to go to prison, and he's not a bad kid, and he knows he's not a bad kid. The system tells him he's a bad kid, and one person intervenes and says, I don't think you're bad. I'm going to give you this opportunity. Let's see what you do with it. And then he's thrown into this position with people that the system has said they're bad. And he's resistant against them. He's like, wait a sec, you guys, I read about you in when I was a kid. You know, you did this and you did that. And then he gets to know them. And then he realizes, you know, that the circumstances that led him to the program and almost led him to going to prison aren't that different, because we find these justifications are more in the cause of what we call survival or just getting by. Our moral compass can shift very greatly depending on the circumstances. It's one thing when we're gainfully employed, but if we lose everything, we may do things that we do not that a year ago we never would have considered doing. And so I get into a lot of that, and then I also get into the fact that, you know, again, what is good and what is evil, and it's and that's the thing, because this book is a lot of shades of gray. And it's we're going even deeper into shades of gray with the sequel, and then the third book, which I've have just the most basic of outlines, but I know where I'm going with it, and it gets bigger and bigger, because it's this right now is the world of superheroes in an earthbound setting, actually really confined to an entire city through the eyes of Darius. The second one will be the world of superheroes and do-gooders through the eyes of Darius, but on a more galactic, cosmic level. And then the third one will be on a very universal level. And it's about this kid who is at the end of the day is sort of at the center of, you know, what's going to happen to the human race. It's, you know, it's the epic hero's journey that you know,
yeah, hero's journey. And I just want to be crystal clear that to me, the reason why it's important to look at novels, the reason why it's important to look, I'm even going to sort of call this maybe a fantasy novel, something
yes,
that's in a fantasy or sci-fi.
Exactly,
what's
yeah.
really important about picking those up is that sometimes a novel can portray more truth about the life you live right now than a newspaper article can, or it's easier for you to take in the lessons of it. I'm just putting that out. And, especially when we're talking about the themes that you just discussed.
Yeah.
So this is not a novel. It's not esoteric. It's not Ivory Tower. This is actually some of the stuff that our young people grapple with all the time. And we have a caller. Let's get that caller on the air. We have Joanne. Joanne, what do you think?
Well, I still can hear some of it. In the 1970s, I started to get away to a lot of wrong things in this country. And one of the things I was exposed to is consciousness raising of feminism. I got involved a little bit in that. And I was listening to Joe Uris's program yesterday, and it brought up some things for me. And he had a friend on there who apparently was sexually abused in the Navy at the age of 18 by a couple of different people. A chaplain was one of them. And he went to the legal part of the Navy, and they put him out with a dishonorable or whatever discharge. And at 19 years, and then I guess he stuffed it or whatever for a lot of years, and for some reason he came out and pursued getting a disability for this sexual abuse from the VA. Well, here's where I'm coming from. I'm thinking also about all kinds of rape all over the world for generations and in jails and that. And I'm thinking, I'd like men to do this, at least in this country. I'd like them in this country to have some kind of consciousness raising about masculinity and how it hurts people in the world. Thank you.
Joanne rocks. That was awesome. Okay, so we're talking about good versus evil.
Yep.
We're talking about how we define those things. Joanne brings up this issue of the military,
yeah.
where, you know, we're realizing that there's a rape scandal in the military that encompasses men as victims as well. And over all these years, we never allowed, I'm a feminist too. But sometimes I wonder back in the early days, if we had created our rape crisis hotlines and really figured out that who knows how many millions of boys had been systematically molested in the Roman Catholic Church, right? Yeah. Good versus evil. Who's good and who's evil? Who tells the children that they're evil? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, exactly.
And so Joanne's talking about, when do men get to do a consciousness-raising thing? And actually, Joanne, that really resonated with me when you said, I mean, I've often thought, especially in the past 10 years, ever since I gave birth to a boy, okay, I started looking at these issues differently, because when I was young, I could say, oh, men are sucky, you know, but now I suddenly couldn't say that anymore. And, you know, one reason why this is an issue for me is that I know a handful of African-American moms and dads whose kids are going into the Portland police.
Yeah.
Okay. And this one in particular, one of my dearest and oldest friends, his son is going to be a Portland police officer, and he wants to go in there because he wants to do very specific, targeted, I'm not even going to say reform. I'm not even going to finish what I'm saying, that kid has an agenda and he wants to do things, right? And so now I find that I can't listen to people say that all Portland police are bad. And I look at...
Isn't that a terrible thing? Isn't it terrible when your ideology is suddenly...
Your karma runs over your dogma.
Yeah,
that's what's happened.
It's...
And so, thank you. And so, I feel as though all these issues are related.
Yeah.
And part of what we're looking at with David Walker, your young adult novel, Darius Logan, Super Justice Force, is looking at men and looking at males and masculinity, and how do we do that? And what does it mean when these men act like they're the good guys, but they tell the kids that the kids are bad guys? I mean, that stuff is deep. It resonates on every level. Joanne, fingers on the pulse. Did you want to respond, David?
No, I think that Joanne is really, you know, she's striking at the heart of a much larger issue. And it's not just about masculinity, and it's not just about men stepping up. It's about human beings stepping up, and each of us taking responsibility for not only our individual actions, but also recognizing the fact that, because I get into this, the conversation I get into is almost always based around race. It's the area that, while other people might be uncomfortable talking about it, I'm very comfortable talking about it. When we start getting into issues of sexuality, gender, I can go there, but I'm not as well versed. I am the one who's usually listening a lot and soaking it in, going, okay, let me, you know, taking notes. But when it comes to race, what I try to tell people is, you know, when someone says to me, oh, well, I'm not racist, or my family's not racist, or, you know, you're talking about slavery, my family didn't own slaves. What I try to explain is that, well, first off, everybody has issues. Everybody has, you might not be racist, but everybody's prejudiced. We all are. It's as plain and simple as that. We may think we're not, but give it time. We can find your prejudices, right? But the other thing is that just because your family didn't own slaves does not mean that you are not.
As far as you know.
Exactly.
Can I put that out, by the way?
I love that one. I don't even do the as far as I know.
I bet you don't even know who your great-grandmother was, so whatever. Sorry, go ahead.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, that there isn't a certain amount of culpability and accountability that must be dealt with when it comes to that particular issue. And I say that because your family may have, you know, migrated here from somewhere in Europe and settled in the northeastern part of the United States in, say, the 1700s or the 1800s, maybe while there still was slavery, mind you, because there was at one point there was slavery all throughout the colonies. But even if they never owned slaves, it does not mean that they did not in some way, shape, or form reap the benefits of slavery and slave culture, because the industry that slavery helped cultivate, the cotton industry, the tobacco industry, all of those things, all citizens of the United States reap the benefits of that.
Okay, so on Democracy Now, okay, just a few weeks ago, there was the most fascinating author on the air there, and I'm looking for that show. This young white woman did an entire book about how she discovered that her northern town, like back in during the transatlantic slave trade and after, every single solitary business benefited from the slave trade. And it was all about people that sold textiles, right? Even though her family didn't enslave people, they made so much money from it. But she dug back even farther and found out that her family was actually her. We were talking about genealogy, like who's your great great grandmother. Her family actually was the richest slave connected family ever.
They made a documentary about
that's this. What it was. Yeah, it was a film documentary. I'm getting confused because I'm thinking of the new film that just came out called Shackle. I'm sorry, the new book that just came out called Shackles and Ivy. That's an interesting one too. digging into how many universities in the United States basically got founded on the backs of enslavement. Yeah. And, you know, I have to say, too, we're progressing through this show. I don't like to call people slave.
Yeah.
Because when you look at that, you know, if I talk about slaves this, slaves that, it seems to imply that they did something to create that condition. I'd rather put the spotlight on the enslaver. So I just, that's just me. Actually, well, Shafia Monroe shared that with me years ago. You know, talk about enslavement, because these people didn't do that. The enslavers get off all the time. But anyway, go ahead and respond.
Well, I can top that, actually, or maybe not top that, but I can add to that, is that when we use terms like slave and slavery, those are actually abstract concepts. They are states of being that do not actually connotate individuals or collective groups. And so when I talk about slavery, I talk about Nelson Hancock, who was my great-great-grandfather, who was born in 1855 on a plantation in Virginia. His father was his owner. His mother was a slave who was sold before he was 5 years old to another plantation. So my great-great-grandfather, Nelson, that's what slavery is. That's what slavery was. Nelson never knew what happened to his mother. He spent his entire life, and I know this from hearing the stories from my grandmother, who knew her grandfather. That's what slavery is. Slavery is a very personal thing that we have, as a nation and as a society, have managed to strip the humanity from it. And therein lies the biggest problem of race and racism in this country, is that we don't talk about it as real people. And so I can talk about it and talk about the fact that, again, my great-great-grandfather was property. Okay. My great-great-great-grandfather, so Nelson's father, owned the property. And, you know, when we start talking, until we can really start talking about it on that level. And so here I am as a person, as a self-identified and also identified by people outside as a person of color, I got to talk about it on both levels. I have to talk about it from the fact that I have flowing through my blood both the blood of the property and the property owner. And the property and the property owner both had names, they had lives, they had families. And so in my book, in my collection of essays,
Becoming Black, Personal Ramblings on Racial Identification, Racism, and Popular Culture, just to be clear.
Thank you for that plug. And I'm fortunate enough to have a picture of my great-great-grandfather. The picture was taken in the 1880s. I don't know for sure when it was taken, but this is when you can tell that this is when photography was just coming into its own. And so I have that history. I'm able to personify it and look at it and go, and I can go back to where the plantation was. I've been to where the plantation was. I have been there. I've walked there. I've walked through the cemetery where all my ancestors, not all my ancestors, but where a significant number of my ancestors are buried. And so I understand it. I get it. And I'm not going to blame anybody, because if I blame anybody, I got to also blame my own family members, but I also have to take culpability in it. And that goes back to what Joanne was talking about. I have to take culpability in my own past sexism, my own past misogyny, which I would love to forget. And in the city of Portland, people that have known me for a long time, they know I've said some things and I've done some things that were questionable. But if I forget those things or ask you to forget them, then we will never learn from those lessons. And so the worst that I've done, I got to own it. You know, I don't wear it like a badge of honor, but I carry it with me everywhere I go, because otherwise, how can I grow as a person? How can you grow as a person? How can we grow as a society if we don't own? And again, it's not about bragging about the worst that we've done, but there has to be lessons learned in every single thing that we do. I learned a lesson this morning, which was, if I want to get here on time, leave 10 minutes earlier, you know?
Okay, I got to jump in here and say, we are live in studio two with David Walker. We're talking about his newest books, Becoming Black and the young adult novel, Darius Logan, Super Justice Force. We got a full slate of callers. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Jomo on the phone. What's going on,
Jomo,
sir?
Hey.
What's going on?
I'm really enjoying the show this morning. Shout out to David. earlier in the show, you were talking about the concept of responsibility. And I would just ask, maybe pose it to both of you, but especially to David, in light of Darius's history as you chose to make him an orphan. Can you talk a little bit about how you feel responsibility plays out both as an artist in creating this art, but also the concept of orphans and young people that need to be taken care of and our responsibility to the young people in our community, and then lastly, finally, responsibility as a creator of media.
Wow.
And creating content.
Thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's a great question. You know,
he had three parts to that. So
yes,
yeah.
I'll try to remember them all and address them. But part of the reason I made Darius an orphan was because in mythology, a lot of great heroes are orphans. And when you're an orphan, you feel abandoned, you feel cut off, you feel you have no family. And
it makes you more of a seeker because you're looking for family.
Exactly. And Darius has a lot of anger issues and rage issues, which play out throughout the book. But what I wanted to give Darius was I didn't want him to find a family. I wanted a family to find him. And so this story is about him developing an extended family, and that extended family are all people he never would have expected. And part of the book gets into this moment where he's trying to understand why these people care about him, why these people are doing for him. And he realizes that with some of the people, it's because they see in him all of the things that they wish they could have done but did not do in time. And it's some of the characters who were, you know, are reformed criminals and reformed villains, for lack of a better term, who see that he's a good kid who's about to go bad, and they would rather keep him as a good kid versus a bad kid who has to then be brought back, if that makes sense. It's I'm speaking in very
good
general terms.
Good versus evil,
yes.
Is a fascinating battlefield. What about this sense that Jomo's asking about the responsibility? Do you feel a responsibility? You already sort of talked about that, but you didn't really go to, you know, you had said that you wrote this book because you were looking for a book like it. You wanted to gift someone important in your life with these ideas, and you realized you had to create it yourself. I mean, is that a sense of responsibility? Do you feel a sense of responsibility towards young people?
I do, and it sounds, you know, I don't want to get into that it takes a, you know, village. I don't want to get into that, but I believe that it's true. And I was fortunate enough to be raised in a very tight-knit community by people who looked out for me even when I wasn't looking out for myself. And the thing is that you don't know you don't know how your lives or the paths of your life are going to cross with somebody today or 10 years from now. And if we are not looking out for each other as a human race collectively, if we're just in it for ourselves or just in it for our family, then we're really in it alone. Because we live in this world together. And so I do believe in this concept that their community building is important. There's some people who are really tight in their communities. I don't happen to be one of those people. You know, I spend most of my time locked away, but I love the opportunity to write for people. And given an opportunity, I was just at PCC last week lecturing, and I'm working out to do some lecturing at some elementary schools and some middle schools. And I love doing that sort of stuff. And I love engaging with young people, more importantly, engaging with them and saying, you know, hey, you know what? You know, how many of you have been told that you're not smart? Or how many of you have been told you won't amount to anything? Because I was told that so much when I was a kid, not by my family, but by teachers. I didn't get good grades. I was that kid that nobody thought, you know, especially when I was younger, thought he's not going to amount to much. And I had people, fortunately, around me, my parents, my neighbors, my grandparents, who told me that's not true. And they pushed and they held on to me. They held on to me strong enough that I never totally lost my sense of humanity. And that's part of what I would like to do. And that's part of what I think we all are obligated to do. And, you know, it's great to watch movies or read books that are just sort of frivolous, escapist entertainment. And I love to participate in the creation or the criticism of that. But there has to be something deeper in what I'm doing, because if we don't go deeper, if we stay shallow, I mean, you can drown in shallow water just as easily as you can drown in deep water. You know, it happens. And so, And I know Jomo, and I thank him for calling in with that question, because him and I have actually talked about this stuff. I do feel a sense of obligation, because I would not be where I am today if there was not people who believed in me and gave me an opportunity when, and even, you know, I joke about this all the time, but, you know, I worked for years at Willamette Week, and I still have a good relationship with some of the people there. And it's like, but they gave me an opportunity. They gave me one of the greatest opportunities of my life. And I'm eternally thankful for that. And there are people out there who have discriminated against me and not treated me well. And I actually thank them for that, too, because that helped build me up into be a stronger person.
Let's go back to the phone line, George. We have a couple more callers. And we have Cheryl on the phone. Cheryl, what's going on with you today? Thank you for waiting.
Oh, fine. I'm happy to wait. This is a good show, important discussion here. Sounds like a really interesting book. I just wanted to say a double hooray also for Joanne's comments, because I think... we have to recognize that men carry a nurturant model in them, not just the predatory one, but the predatory aspect of masculinity is ruining the world, ruining women and children's lives.
And men too.
Men, yes, you're right, absolutely, the victimization of men. And men of strong, good heart and nurturant heart need to step forward, speak out, and connect with one another. Everyone needs to connect with one another on a nurturant level, because the fact of the matter is that there's mental predation as well as physical, and also women involve themselves too in predatory behavior, often psychological but also physical. It can be, and we have to become nurturants. Anyone can destroy, anyone can stalk, anyone can make other people's lives miserable or even wreck a planet, but being productive and preserving a planet and preserving people's lives and helping one another, that's a true mature challenge, and men can embrace that in greater and greater numbers, be brave, stand up for women, speak out against the indoctrination through the media, which is nothing but hate against women.
All right, Cheryl.
That's all I have to say.
Thank you so much for calling. Sure. And we have another caller, but I want to say this really quick. I was so surprised yesterday. I saw where former Attorney General of Washington State, Rob McKenna, is now a lobbyist for coal. And he's coming out, and he's lobbying for coal. And he's basically trying to make it so that as they come up with their plan in Washington State about their coal trains or whatever, he's trying to make it so that no considerations for climate or global warming are included. And I mean, Sherelle just made me just flash on that. That freaks me out. I mean, you're talking about burning down the planet. Anyway, I'm just saying. So let's go back to the phone lines. Who else we have over there? We have David over there. David, what do you got?
Well, can you hear me all right?
It's really hard to hear you, so go ahead and make it brief. It sounds like you're talking on an egg beater or something.
How's this? Is that better?
That's way better. Thanks. What you got on your mind?
I just wanted to say thanks for the program today, and just thank you for saying that you are a racist. I don't even know your name. I've been running around working this morning, but thank you for saying that, because I have so many friends that say, well, I'm not racist, I'm not this, but it's so true that we are all racist. If you know, as a white male, I mean, I am a racist, you know, and I have to admit it. And I don't disparage people of color. And in fact, I'm so glad that the Hispanics are in my neighborhood. I mean, I walk down the street and they have a lot of nerve. I mean, they're out there on summer afternoons. The whole family's out in the front yard. They're barbecuing. I mean, what are they trying to teach me? This is really great. But I will admit that I grew up, I'm an old school kind of guy, and I grew up with racism. I grew up with sexism, and I also want to say that I'm a homophobe. I admitted this to my ex-girlfriend's daughter. She was about what? She's like 13, and she freaked out. And I had to explain to her that being homophobic doesn't mean that I disparage gays or lesbians, or that I want to hurt them. It just means that, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable when I see two gay men being affectionate in public.
Right on, David. Thank you so much for calling. You've given me some things to think about. I have to think about what's going on there. So let's go. There's one more caller. Let's go back to the phone line. We have Edie on the phone. Edie, what's on your mind?
If you would have you and your listeners look at Everyday Feminism online, Everyday Feminism, men, women, people of color getting together and really having that conscious raising, healing, what are some of the underlying beliefs that have been oppressing them and making them complicit in the oppression of others, and how to be free and be a part of it, liberating others also, the social change. And some of this deep spiritual, private individual, but not only reading theory and doing your journaling, but also online, back and forth with folks in a weekly conference call around the, you know, people around the world, calling in and giving each other moral support, so that it's not just a professor or a reading assignment. It's not just a therapist. You can also have your private call in with someone.
All like right, Edie. Great. Thank you so much. Everydayfeminism.com, I guess, is probably .com. I also want to say this. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, Teresa Mitchell interviews Michael Kimmel, author of Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. And, you know, just to be clear, Teresa Mitchell is one of our favorite transgendered programmers here. So that's going to be a really fascinating conversation. At 10 on Flashpoints, Gareth Porter, love Gareth Porter, analyzes the recent Iran nuclear agreement. Also in Santa Rosa, California, young Latinos continue to protest recent police killing of 13-year-old Andy Lopez. Immigrants' rights activists protest ongoing massive deportations, and Bill Means of the American Indian Movement talks about the battle to decolonize the Washington Redskins. At 11 on the Recovery Zone, author Will Tuttle discusses the world peace diet and how a shift in food choices could help the environment increase food for the world's poor and reconnect people with innate feelings of compassion. Sounds like a good idea. And we are live in Studio 2 with David Walker. We have merged into talking about his book, Becoming Black, Personal Ramblings on Racial Identification, Racism, and Popular Culture. It's a book of essays, which means that you can sit there and read parts of it at a gulp and come back and read more. And David, diving into this book, I'm going back to what David said. David here, he called a little earlier and said he admits that he's racist and he's homophobic and he feels uncomfortable when he sees men holding hands. And I'm not sure what I think about that, but kind of where I hear him going is if he can admit that those are his feelings and be clear about them, then maybe we can talk about it and we can overcome our fear of seeing anybody holding hands. I just want to put it out. We probably shouldn't be afraid. If people are holding hands, that would imply joy. Yeah. But anyway, go ahead. What do you think about that? And I mean, do you look at this here? Like, what if you are a person who is pretty much from the privileged class? I'll say, yeah. Even though I think that when we talk about the privileged class, there's a lot of people in the white community that are totally oppressed and completely poor and living on the street.
They just might not be aware that they at that their level of oppression.
There you go. So
because let's go for it. I mean, race is a huge issue in this country. Sex is a huge issue in this country. Class is a huge issue in this country. And we have such a great we've done such a good job of smoke and mirrors that sometimes we lose sight of what the real issues are. My personal philosophy is that there are the oppressors and there are the oppressed, right? And the thing is that we are all oppressors, even if we are part of the oppressed. It is part of, I believe, it may even be within our genetic makeup, is that we will always look for someone weaker to prey upon to make us feel better about ourselves. And so you see that within the black community, you see that within the gay community, you see that there's all sorts of divisions and infighting. And what it really comes down to is that we have to stop oppressing, because when we dehumanize another, we are also giving up our own humanity. You cannot oppress another human being. You cannot, if you are engaging in a sexist act, then if you are objectifying or oppressing a woman or a person of color, you have to give up something of yourself in order to do that. And so it's a lose-lose situation. You know, there's no winning there. And so I can't speak for David, the caller who just called in, but it's like, I admit to my own homophobia at times. I am not a homophobic person now. At least I don't think I am. But I may be, and if someone calls me on it and tells me about it and points out the things that I'm doing, you know, I mean, I'm in a relationship with the most beautiful human being of all time, and she is a feminist, and she will call me
She's fierce.
She is fierce.
Are we naming names?
Yes, we will. She might get, I don't think she'll get upset, but I'm in
a... It would be totally worth it to name names, because the person that you're in a relationship also has an amazing project around some of this exact same stuff. Anyway, go ahead.
Walida Imarisha is who I'm involved in a relationship with. She is both a social activist, a political activist, an organizer.
An educator
and a poet, a writer. And she's an amazing human being. And, you know, and people who know us go, oh, you guys are a great couple. And we're like, yeah, we are a good couple. Part of it is because we're constantly calling each other on what we're doing wrong. And she tends to call me on mine more because I think maybe I have more. I don't know. Sometimes I'll get upset or whatever, but it's like she's not coming from a bad place. If I say something wrong or do something wrong, then, you know, she will point it out to me, and sometimes, you know, my blood pressure goes up a little bit, but I will stop and I'll slow down and I'll think about it. And I realize that there's more than one way to think about everything. And it's called the big picture, and it's called thinking outside the box. And, what she gives to me and what I give to her is that we're opening up each other's view of the world. And I think that we can all do that to each other. If we can just simply, you know, look at the world and go, it's not just me. There is a bigger picture. There's multiple sides, you know. I mean, a sphere doesn't even have sides, you know.
We've got a bunch of callers. Let's just try to rip through the callers on the phone line. Let's go back to the phone line. We've got Leslie on the phone. Leslie, what's going on with you?
Hi, good morning, Lisa Loving.
Hello.
Good morning, David Walker. I just want to say I want to put some of your books on my Christmas list. You sound like a really interesting writer, and I want to check out your work.
All right.
Okay.
Becoming Black, Personal Ramblings on Racial Identification, Racism, and Popular Culture. And then also Darius Logan, Super Justice Force. The website, badassmofo.com.
Actually, the even easier is the David Walker... Yes, the David Walker site, all one word.
The David Walker site
is a portal to everything. Everything's up on Amazon. You can find it if you do a search of me. So,
although we should probably get those. We should look for those at independent bookstores. But Leslie, your phone line is popping up. So I'm going to cut you loose because we're getting this feedback thing. But thank you so much for calling. That's really awesome. And let's go to the next caller. Connie, what's going on with you?
Hey, I'd like to say something like... Becoming Black too.
Okay.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like maybe about 6 years ago, I became a little bit black myself, even though I'm Caucasian. But when my niece married a young man who is African American and Korean American, and I felt like, okay, he is of my blood now, so I will defend, you know, anyone who, or come up against anyone who tries to say anything racist.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for calling. Really appreciate your call.
And I say, hey, that's blood of my blood. You cannot say anything like that. That's
awesome.
You know,
that's awesome. So we're going to go to the next caller because we're running out of show. And is it Ed? Ed, are you there?
Yeah, Ed here.
What's going on, Ed?
Hi, I just wanted to give a shout out to a great book for young men, and it's written by a relatively new author named Dan Whedon, and the book is called Albacora, and it's a great book for teenage boys or young men, or more, just about anybody for that matter. It's
awesome,
very entertaining,
Ed.
And he's a local guy, and It's about a young man's first adventure away from home.
Great. Awesome.
I'll check that out.
Thank
sure.
you so much, sir. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We've got a few more minutes in the studio here with David Walker. He's pretty much our favorite local film guy, critic, commentator. He's got the Super Justice Force. Now, I really do want to point people towards this book, Becoming Black. And now what I heard you say was that you're working to get these books in the independent bookstores, but they're not there yet?
Not there yet. I mean, right now it's, you know, writing the stuff is difficult enough. And I'm wrapping up school at Merrillhurst and in a relationship with a wonderful human being who I don't give enough time to. And so it's like it's a slow grind. It's a slow process. But I know, you know, Powell's I need to get into Powell's. And Portland is lucky because we have a ton of great independent booksellers, which is, of course, a dying, you know, industry in and of itself. So, and I just want to address the woman who called. I can't remember her name. She was talking about her niece. And that's how it begins. You see, she's opened her door a little, you know, a little bit or a lot, but she's opened the door and realizing that the world is a much bigger place and there's complex issues and that her family has now gotten bigger. And if she continues down this path, she'll realize that we're all part of one big family, which is the human race. I don't want to get into singing We Are the World or anything like that, but
stop it. Okay. Don't stop it. You know what's interesting about that? So I've been doing research on global warming, right? And the racial politics of global warming are fascinating and amazing and very critical. And I'm not even talking about the global politics of the Southern Hemisphere now. I'm talking about the United States.
Yeah.
And a Latino community, right? Latino community, I'm going to say 4 years ago, I found a lot of coverage over the fact that a 17-year-old girl died of heat exhaustion just right in a field. Like she was working at a mm-hmm. grape harvest, just died of heat exhaustion because it was so hot. And they're looking at how people that work out of doors, people who are, I'm going to say field workers, I don't know if it's migrant workers so much, but people that have to work outside like that are going to really be disproportionately impacted by what happens when it gets to be 122 degrees on a routine level in California, mm-hmm. like every summer. And so I started doing that. And so there's movements coming out called the New Majority. And I went to a lot of websites where that was the slogan, we are the new majority. Yeah. And so when you were talking about what the woman just said a couple minutes ago about how she, you know, she feels as though she's becoming black because she's embracing her family so much. I don't know what kind of response you're going to get if you say that in public a lot. It's going to be complicated because, again, you know, are we ready,
yeah.
you know, to deal with who we think we are? But I will say these things are changing. And if the dominant paradigm doesn't figure out a way to embrace how to make multiculturalism work, all, you know, that dominant paradigm is going to find itself in the minority. Already you're listening to people talk about Republicans in Congress as the minority. And that freaks me out. It cracks me up, but it freaks me out. So I want to give you the last word, David Walker. Yeah. We're starting to run out of show, but we do have like 2 minutes left. What's the most important thing that people will find if they pick up this book, Becoming Black? What do you think is the most important thing? Because people of color are going to want to read it, but I know a lot of white people want to understand, you know, who we are and how we stand. So what are people going to find there?
What they're really going to find there is I was looking at the intersection of history and popular culture, racial identification and popular culture, and really looking at like how the concept of what it means to be black, and that's that the all these essays are built around the concept of what is black, and it's this is all from my perspective. This is all based on my research and my personal experiences and a lot of the books that I've read, and it's really getting into the fact that everything really is connected, so that the movies that we watch and the books that we read and the music that we listen to, there's more to it than what appears on the surface. And we need to understand how, say, a film like Gone with the Wind came to exist and how it has impacted us on a not just a, you know, national level, but on a global level, and how it has impacted both our perception of history and our perception of race. And so I'm trying to get people to think critically and own their own place in history. That's, I think, really what it's all about.
Okay, now I have to ask you one more last question. So you're finishing book two.
Yes.
In the Super Justice Force trilogy.
Yep.
You are wrapping up. I want to say, are you getting a master's degree?
No, I'm actually getting my undergrad. I went back to school after 20-something years and decided time to, put my money where my mouth is. So
that's where I would be. So writing and commentating on the site Badass Mofo, and it's AZZ, right?
Yep.
Do you see yourself becoming an educator or a professor or a teacher or something like that in the future?
Perhaps. I like lecturing and I like talking to people. I don't want to fill out lesson plans and grade papers, or I don't want to.
It's a software thing that I know people just, it makes people crazy.
Yeah. So I, you know, I'm open to doing lectures and I love coming to talk to people, and especially young people. And so that's what I'm working towards. That's really what I'm working towards is sort of being, I want to be like, you know, a speaker. I want to be like Tony Robbins or Dr. Phil. I
know, except useful. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. That's it for our show. People, if you're thinking, if you work with kids, all kinds of kids, you should go to that site, thedavidwalkersite.com or badassmofo, badassmofo.com. Special thanks to, thanks to our guest, David Walker. Thanks for being
Thank
here.
You.
It's always a pleasure. A special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky, the studio dog. This show will be podcast on KBOO.FM. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. And stay tuned for Teresa Mitchell and Michael Kimmel, author of Angry White Men. Thanks for listening.
Is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
The Recovery Zone 11 to noon this Wednesday to find out how our food choices may be affecting the environment, our health, and our relationships with one another.
If we really are serious about wanting to have peace on this planet, we have to look at the ramifications of our food choices. We're not some kind of species that is fundamentally flawed. We're always going to have domination and war and so forth. We're born into a culture essentially with an obsolete food orientation. The beauty of the message is that we absolutely can transform our culture.
Learn more from Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, on the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland this Wednesday, November 27th, from 11 to noon. Your turkey day could well never be the same.